Welcome everyone to the House Committee on Judiciary. We've got a number of bills up today, so we're going to try to move as expeditiously as possible through the agenda. I am going to start actually at the bottom of the agenda. And we're going to go to a quick work session on House Bill 2270. So I would open a work session on House Bill 2270. Council, you want to bring us up to speed on this one?
Sure. House Bill 2270 is regarding termination of beneficiary designations upon divorce. I have two sets of amendments, dash ones and dash twos.
And I think we've got someone here from the Oregon State Bar to address issues that were raised originally on the bill. Ms. Todd, are you here? If you want to come up, maybe just speak to the committee briefly about the dash one and the dash two amendments, that would be helpful. And just identify yourself for the record.
All right. I'm Jennifer Todd. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Salem. I'm a member of the Estate Planning and Administration section of the bar, and the chair of the executive committee of that session called me yesterday and asked me to be here. I'm also past Judge Pro Tem in Marion County Probate Court for 5 years, so this is an area I'm familiar with. As far as the Dash 1 amendments, I believe that there was no concern from our section regarding those. That is completely acceptable as far as we're concerned. That's the Dash 2 amendments, in which you would, instead of disclaimer, you would treat the situation as though the person had predeceased the principal.
And if I could just stop you here briefly, Ms. Todd, and ask Representative McPherson to help us remind the committee. You'll recall that we've had sort of two of these similar kinds of bills, and both Representative Shetterly and Representative McPherson raised concern one of them was tracking generally with the way wills operate, and one of them wasn't. And by using the predeceased the principal language in the dash two amendments and amending this bill, it would be putting them all essentially using that same mechanism and tracking with the will statute. Am I accurate?
Yes, exactly.
And is that your recollection as to?
It is, in fact. The other bill relates to living trusts.
Right.
And there the rule was stated as it is now in the amendment, that is that the effect of divorce is to treat the spouse as having predeceased rather than having disclaimed. And so this puts them in alignment.
Great. Thank you, Representative McPherson. So that explains the dash two, and that amendment primarily we would attribute, I think, to Representative Shetterly and Representative McPherson raising the issue in the committee.
You're too kind. It was actually Representative Shetterly who spotted that and gave me thereby a little tutorial on the distinction between disclaimers and predeceased.
And all of us as well. And we
you said it was you.
And we appreciate him for it. And now, Ms. Todd, the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay. On these amendments, the first, and I presume the primary concern, is the use of the word power of attorney in line 2. And the concern there is that a power of attorney is not a beneficiary designation type of a document. It doesn't operate to transfer benefits upon the death of someone. What a power of attorney does is it grants authority to an agent to act on behalf of the person signing the power of attorney. And so it really doesn't fit in this type of bill. And in addition, the way that you would revoke a power of attorney would be notify the third parties that you don't want it anymore, which is required in this bill. So if you do want to include power of attorney, the bill would need to be reworded in some way to reflect the nature of the power of attorney.
And you're going to have to maybe help me out, or you might not know. Do you know where the Dash 1 amendments originated from? Joyce, do you want to come up?
Uh, Thank you, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Joyce Patton with the Oregon State Bar Public Affairs Program. If you recall, the Dash 1 amendments were actually discussed by Representative Shetterly, and it was specifically addressing the concern about the limitation in terms of the governing instruments. And as a result of that, Chair Williams, you had asked Representative Shetterly to work with legislative counsel to develop Dash 1 amendments that would attempt to broaden the description of governing instruments. And this is the amendments that Representative Shetterly forwarded on to the Oregon State Bar for us to take a look at. And the section is in agreement with the amendments as Representative Shetterly and Mr. Hendricks have drafted.
Including the Dash 1s?
Including the Dash 1s.
Okay,
the Dash 1s are from Representative Shetterly's discussions.
Well, it's the man of the hour. We're working your damned amendments.
Mr. Speaker.
Chair.
We're actually talking about the Dash 1s, but I understand, Ms. Todd, that you had concerns about the line. We're on 2270. You had concerns about the use of the word, of the phrase, a power of attorney in line 2. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. Explain it again for me, if
okay.
you could.
Well, this 2270 is about instruments that cause assets to transfer to someone else upon a person's death. What a power of attorney does is it grants authority to another person to act during the person's lifetime. It ends at that person's mm-hmm. death. It doesn't cause any assets to transfer at death by its nature. And so, and in addition, given the nature of a power of attorney, to revoke a power of attorney, you have to notify the third parties as you would need to in 227B. I don't really know that it needs to be included in the bill.
So your sense would be then, or your recommendation would be, that where it says creates or exercises, would be to strike a power of attorney or,
yes.
and just have it say creates or exercises a power of appointment upon the death.
Yes.
And remove the power of attorney reference. Okay, that's helpful for me. Representative Sherrill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm surprised. I had an email exchange with David Hendricks, it looks like yesterday, where he raised this issue, and I suggested that the amendment be changed to delete the power of attorney language. So I guess I thought we might see that today.
Okay.
But I think conceptually that would be where
we're all in agreement on
yeah.
that. All right. And we've already discussed the Dash 1s, the predeceased, the principal amendment generally, and have given you appropriate attribution along with sub-attribution to Representative McPherson on the subject matter. Are there any questions either for Ms. Patton or for Ms. Todd about the amendments?
I had another point to make.
Oh, please do.
Regarding it would be on starting on line 8, of the Dash 1 amendment, subsection H. And again, this concern was raised by Bernie Vail, so, and I think it's a valid concern. The concern was that the way that this is worded, where it talks about a bank account or other financial account that is payable or transferable upon death, that could be interpreted to apply not only to pay on death accounts, accounts that someone owns, and then on their death, it's paid to another person. It's possible that that could be interpreted to apply to joint bank accounts where whoever survives gets what's left in the account. And our feeling is that that needs to be clarified. And my feeling is that usually these joint accounts are dealt with on divorce. And so the concern that we're really trying to address in this bill is the kind that are payable on death or transfer on death.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
Well, again, in the same email exchange, it would be easy to add language that would make it clear that spouses basically relating to this joint interest in bank account and other financial accounts. So is there an amendment out there that just hasn't caught up with this bill?
Well, it sounds like there may be, Representative Shetterly. But
frankly, I expect to see both of those here today.
David, if you're listening, Well, what I think we ought to do is I was willing to potentially make the power of attorney change conceptually on the fly. I'm not sure I'm ready to make the joint bank account issue on the fly. So what I think we'll do is, since we're in work session, why don't we go ahead and move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments so we just know that we're making some progress in getting them in, and we'll wait for the Dash 3 amendment to catch up to us. Does that sound appropriate?
That's good.
All right.
Mr. Chair, also I have one comment on the Dash 1 amendment.
Yes.
There's part of it is to insert a new G, which would be a profit-sharing plan. And I'm was that in response to something Representative Shetterly that you had discussed with the Legislative Council?
Mr. Chair, I think not specifically. I think the idea there was to expand the list to capture more of the types of instruments that pass on death. I don't recall any specific discussion about profit-sharing plans.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could, the terminology in 4A of an employee pension benefit plan would pick up all profit-sharing plans that have an accumulated account in them, and would, I think, sufficiently broad probably to pick up all the vehicles that would be likely picked up by a profit-sharing plan. The only thing that would not pick up in that definition is something that is of a more a cash non-qualified nature. And those sometimes have death beneficiary designations, but most typically do not. So I don't feel strongly about it, but it's one of those things where I'm not sure that adding the specific reference to profit sharing plan is desirable.
Okay. Any comments from the panel on that point?
No.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sheriff.
Oh, just in fairness to poor Mr. Hendricks, I think they are just inundated down there with
that
these. These bill requests, I'm sure that probably accounts for the lag here.
Yeah, I'm certain that that's the case, and we certainly understand their workload. I did send, just to make sure that while we've got the bill up today, to Mr. Joseph, just to make sure that it just didn't get crossed in the mail somewhere. But assuming that it's on its way, we'll just end up rescheduling the bill for work session. But while in work session, Representative Shirley moves.
Thank you. Move the Dash 2 amendments.
Moves the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments. Is there any discussion? Any objection? All right. We've adopted the Dash 2 amendments, and we'll wait for the changes that were discussed for the Dash 1 amendments for another time. And now that we've sort of fully vetted that, I don't think that we'll necessarily need to have anybody back, if assuming the amendments say what everybody thinks they'll say, and we'll get this bill out of here. So with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2270. Now we'll move back up to the top of the agenda. And we will start with a public hearing on House Bill 2048. So we'll open a public hearing on that. Okay, 2048, and I've sent Mr. Joseph off, so he's not here to give us an introduction. But 2048 allows the court to set aside conviction or record of arrest for traffic offense under certain circumstances. We've got some folks signed up for it. Welcome back, Mr. Joseph. By the way, I need to announce it to everyone today that today is Mr. Joseph's birthday today.
Oh,
we would sing, but I'm not sure people would want to actually hear us sing for your birthday. So happy birthday, Bill.
Cover the mic.
Should we take a committee poll on how old Mr. Joseph is?
Old enough to buy us a drink, I think.
Old enough to buy us a drink.
34.
34?
Whoa.
Right on the money, Jerry.
Bingo.
That's all right.
Wait. Yes. Can I ask Representative Crumble when Sunny Die is going to be?
You might want to know.
June 14th.
Oh, hey.
Whoa, what year?
2009.
Mr. Joseph has just told me that that amendment that we were talking about on the previous bill will be to us before the end of the meeting. David saw that it was probably at the end of the agenda and assumed that he had through the meeting to get it done. So we'll reopen the work session if we get the amendment before the end of the meeting and take care of it today. So with House Bill 2048 being open, public hearing, I want to invite Kelly Skye and Carl Myers to come up. In fact, if it's okay, Kelly, I'm going to have Carl lead off on this to give us a little bit of background on the bill. Is that all right? Okay.
What bill are we on?
It's 2048.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Carl Myers. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon Justices, the Peace Association, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association, and sort of in an amicus capacity, in as much as I worked with Council Bill Taylor over the interim to craft a bill that was more acceptable. Last session, you had House Bill 2860, which would have allowed for the expungement of municipal traffic offenses. And I might say before we get started, and for the benefit of Representative Shetterly, the word expungement does not appear in the statute in any fashion, and probably when it is used in this context is used wrongly. It is a motion to set aside a conviction, but all of us lawyers have used the word expunction at one point to so designate, so I will continue to use the word expungement, but I know that I'm using it in a in the wrong meaning. In any event, 2860 appeared last session, would have allowed expungement of municipal traffic offenses. It would have allowed for expungement in the context of this, of the expungement statute, after 3 years. There were some problems with that. First of all, it only related to municipal traffic offenses, in which, and there are, in fact, most of the traffic offenses or convictions you get are state traffic offense convictions. It would have allowed for expunction after 3 years, and quite honestly, judges and the DMV use records in most cases that are 10 years old, and in some cases, and you'll hear today from the Department of Motor Vehicles that they keep records on some cases beyond 10 years. And the reason for that is there are a number of enhanced penalties for DUII, for instance, and some other things where if you've had a and DUII diversion, if you've had a conviction within the last 10 years, you're not eligible. So there is a public policy that suggests that we at least need to keep those records for 10 years. And most, and you need to understand in reference to this, for most purposes, your driving record is clear after 5 years. Insurance companies don't even get a record that is over 3 years old. So we're not talking about taking expunging your speeding tickets or whatnot. Those again come off your record fairly quickly. As a judge, I get records that are 5 years old, except on major traffic crimes. So your speeding and your failing to come to a stop at a stoplight and those kinds of things are generally off your record fairly soon anyway. It became clear at the end of last session that 2860 had problems and needed to be considered in light of all the other aspects of the statutes that it would affect, and so the bill died in committee. During the interim, I took this concept to the Oregon Law Commission, as I promised its sponsor last session was Representative Carl Wilson. I promised him that I would try to come up with a solution. We took the bill in front of the Oregon Law Commission. The Oregon Law Commission refused to get involved in this discussion, in large part because they had more concerns about the whole expungement statute than just this one amendment. Did not seem to be inclined at that point to want to allow more matters to be set aside. In fact, we're concerned about the whole public policy of expungement in the large sense. So they refused take it on. At that point, Council Taylor and I commissioned a draft that would have done two things, would have allowed for the expungement of traffic offenses after 10 years and would not have allowed DUIIs to be expunged. The bill that you have in front of you now is allows for expungement of all traffic convictions after a 10-year period. It does not address the DUII situation, and I have called to Council Joseph's attention, and I call to the committee's attention, Oregon Revised Statute 813.010, which is the driving under the influence of intoxicants statute. Subsection, subparagraph B, allows for enhanced penalties for convictions of DUII, and it does not have a time limit on it. Other sections of that statute do have a time limit of 10 years, but the enhanced penalties does not. For that reason, the judges' associations, which I might add are real concerned about the whole expungement concept as a public policy, nevertheless, as one judge told me, if they're going to allow a thief to expunge their record, a felony DWS expungement doesn't seem like such a bad public policy. Nevertheless, with the concern about the DUII enhanced penalties, if that could be addressed, the judges would not oppose this bill. Mr. Chair, I hope that I have set the history so the committee understands it, where this bill has come from. I might add that this bill came from a concern of a constituent of Representative Wilson's. I did have a chance to talk to that constituent last session, and the circumstances there, just so that you're aware, he had a felony driving while suspended, which occurs when your license has been suspended as a habitual traffic offender and you get a subsequent driving while suspended. Then it makes it a driving while suspended felony. It had come off of his driving record, as I said, after 10 years, but remained on his criminal history as a felony conviction, which made him ineligible for some occupations that require that you have a felony-free record. That is the genesis of this bill. To the extent that I can help in this discussion, I have talked with judges across the state. We don't know how many cases there are that would take advantage of this. There is a concern that will be expressed, I think, by some that if there are a large number, that it will be a major work impact for local courts, JP courts, and municipal courts. My sense is that there may be only one or two, possibly three people who, if this were made available to them, would take advantage of it, because, again, it only really impacts those that need a felony-free record if you keep the 10-year time limit in. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm happy to answer any general questions that I can.
Good. Thank you, Carl. Are there questions for Mr. Myers about this bill, or particularly the procedural history of this issue? Yes, Representative Barker.
Thank you. I got an email the other night from somebody, not one of my constituents, but a constituent nonetheless, who said there's a bill coming up to allow somebody who's been involved in a drunk driving negligent homicide case to get that pulled after 10 years. This is not addressing that, I hope.
I do not know, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I don't know of that bill. There is another bill that would prohibit expungement of crimes that are that result from a person-to-person type crime, your robbery kinds and assault kinds of things that are not otherwise prohibited in the current statute. I don't know of the bill that you refer to.
This bill does not do that, is what I'm asking.
This bill would allow for the expungement of DUIIs after 10 years.
And if there was a death involved in that?
It may be under one of the other exceptions. I don't know.
Okay, thank you.
Maybe
it certainly would be under the other person to the other bill. That's, I think, a Senate bill.
And that's a question Ms. Skye might be able to answer too for you, Representative Barker. We'll see.
Thank you.
Representative Shetterly and then Representative Ackerman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I think to respond about the procedural posture of the bill. Carl says the Law Commission refused. I would say respectfully declined
For one thing, I've busted my pick on this statute on probably just about every session I've been in the legislature. It is one of the most horrifically complicated and convoluted statutes in the books. And I think this request came in at a time where we pretty well identified the legislative agenda for this current session. This would have been something to take on that would not have developed through the Law Commission anyway, at least until next session. So I think the sense was that there wasn't, we didn't have resources to devote to this to get anything in during the, for this session, again, especially appreciating how complicated the statute is once you start peeling back those layers.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly's is correct. They did not refuse. It was a workload issue and a number of other things, but it was specifically mentioned to me that it was a complex area and they didn't want to handle just one aspect of the expungement. And as a practitioner, I can tell you that this statute is complex. I've had to make a flow chart to figure out whether my clients are eligible or not.
Okay. Yeah. Just like HIPAA, right. Yeah. Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm having a trouble conceiving what's broken here. We're being asked to fix something, but do you have any idea what's broken? What is the motivation behind this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ackerman, all I can relate is that the specific instance that are from which this bill arose, and that was that a gentleman had a felony conviction for driving while suspended that he could not get off his criminal history. Had he, in fact, been charged with robbery, theft, or a number of other crimes, he would have had that off his record. And it seemed unfair to him, and I think Representative Wilson, and to us on at least a conceptual basis, that a felony driving while suspended is certainly not worse than some of the other crimes for which you can get your record expunged. That does not take into account that traffic matters are significantly different in their handling both up front and afterwards than most crimes, but nevertheless, that's how this bill arose, and that's the concern that some have with the handling of this, the exception to the traffic crime expungement.
I guess that, if I could have one follow-up,
yes,
Mr. Chair, I would think that if it was a DWS felony, Class C felony, you'd still have the right under the other expungement statutes to have this record cleared. So I'm suggesting there's a remedy for the motivation behind this bill. Are you familiar with expungement on Class C felonies?
All I know is what the statute says, and it says that an exception to the expungement are traffic offenses, convictions for traffic offenses, and DWS is a traffic offense. So I'm not sure that other it may well exist. I have not tried it, and apparently it was not successful in the underlying case.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Cromwell?
Well, I'm really pretty duly confused. I'm more confused with this than I was with HIPAA. But you made a comment about a DWF, or were you saying
DWS, driving while suspended? I'm sorry.
Thank you. No, that's okay.
DUI is driving under the influence of intoxicants. I apologize to the committee for acronymal use.
But that was just sort of a side question. I thought you'd said F and not S, and I was trying to figure out what it was. But that's okay. Yeah, what I'm having a hard time understanding is in section 1A, it's beginning on line 5, it talks about it anytime after a lapse of 3 years from the date of pronouncement of judgment or 10 years if the conviction was for a traffic offense. So that's sort of telling me that in this particular statute that a traffic offense is more serious than any other kind of offense. And I'm not sure I understand what the offense would be. And then when we get down to line 14, and it says if the arrest was for a traffic offense, the arrested person by motion may apply to the court, at any time after a lapse of 10 years from the date of the arrest. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what is it that would that you can have taken off your record after 3 years, but a driving offense is so serious that it has to wait 10 years. I guess that's my confusion. So maybe you can help me, or somebody can somebody help me? Or am I beyond help?
Representative Prozanski, do you want to respond to Representative Kremel?
The issue is there are many different enhancements that occur within the traffic offense sector. DMV keeps records for online for notifying, such as like for DUII, driving under the influence of intoxicants. Okay. In our state, you can go into a diversion program if you have not been in a program or convicted of that crime in the last 10 years. And so there's a timing of knowing for the prosecutors to say this person has already gone through a diversion, and it shows on their driving record as the DIVR for diversion. So we know that they've been in this program already within a 10-year period. Or if it's lapsed over 10 years, that means they are eligible to go through it again. Or if they have been convicted of DUII, then they would not be eligible to do the diversion program. So that's one, example of why you would need that. It does, when you look at it, as Representative Shirley says, this is, I think, the worst statutes that's still on the books as to being clear to understanding what they're attempting to do, because you have so many exceptions to the exceptions to the general rule, then an exception built on top of it. Well, you know, one of my plugs would be we should take this thing, rework the whole thing, and bring back a better thing, which is not for us to do. But knowing what the issues are, DMV has a obligation to maintain certain records on file so everyone knows what has happened over these different periods of 5 years, 10 years, and in some cases if someone has been convicted of a homicide involving a motor vehicle, their suspension doesn't go into effect until after they're released from prison, if I'm not mistaken. And so if you have someone that serves 7 years in custody, and then you start their revocation of their license for 7 or 8 years, whatever the length of time is, you can see where you get past that 10 years. I don't know if that helps. Even though someone that has a Class C felony that's not a sex crime can get their record expunged after 3 years.
Okay. I think we're going to move this along. I'm going to ask Ms. Skye to come forward. Thank you very much, Carl. Kelly, are you ready?
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Skye. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we noticed this bill in the system and weren't quite sure where it came from. However, we have presented bills similar to this in the past, mostly dealing with the actual traffic arrests. The bill, I agree with Representative Przanski and Representative Kremel, is not a model of clarity, and perhaps creating exceptions isn't the best way to go about it. However, as Mr. Myers indicated, there are some real disproportionate consequences to the way that that this statute is written, that in accepting traffic offenses. And to start with the constituent who raised this issue, who had the felony driving while suspended on his record, that could have been his only criminal conviction on his record. And one of the other severe consequences is that he would forever be prohibited from possessing a firearm. And those are cases that we see occasionally. That's a very serious felony offense, unlawful possession of a firearm, or a felon in possession of a firearm. And sometimes the underlying felony is merely a felony driving while suspended. So so it is important to recognize, as Representative Kremel did, the disproportionate results of accepting traffic offenses. And I also understand Representative Barker and Representative Przanski's concerns about the upper end traffic offenses involving deaths, that would have also a disproportionate effect to merely adding traffic offenses in. So while I understand that this bill has a number of problems, we would encourage the committee to consider including traffic offenses, because it is very frustrating when I find myself representing a client who can who sees the person sentenced before them to on a felony theft, that the judge advises them that if you do well and complete your probation that you will be able to get your conviction expunged, but the person who has the reckless driving conviction will never be able to get that expunged. With that said, the other comment I wanted to make was Mr. Myers suggested that this may create a backlog of cases and an increased caseload for some judges, and I would want to point out that I don't think that it probably would. There is no right to counsel. As you can see, it's not a consumer-friendly statute, so it's not something that a lot of people do on a pro se basis, except for people to whom it is extremely important. And those are the people that that we use this, and those are the people that brought this before you. So we would encourage you to consider adding back in the ability to expunge traffic convictions, if not convictions, just perhaps arrests, because another place where this has a disproportionate impact is if someone is arrested on a reckless driving or a DUI and they are acquitted, they still have that arrest on their record, and that will come up in some circumstances. The arrest will still show, and to some people that's very important to have their arrest record cleared if they've been cleared by a judge or a jury. So those were the only comments I had.
Okay, good. Are there questions for Ms. Guy? Representative Barker.
Thank you. I was just interested in something you said there. So when I read in the paper that the gun loophole law or whatever has prevented 5,000 serious felons from obtaining firearms, or 4,000 of those people who are driving while suspended and not really violent criminals?
I don't know what the figures are, and I wouldn't say that that a good number of those are driving while suspended, but they are prosecuted. We do see them, and they are somewhat frustrating because it's not something that sometimes even hits the radar screen for someone who has, say, a felony driving while suspended conviction that they would be prohibited from owning a firearm.
That's what I was asking. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed like somebody might not know that and walk in not thinking of that being a felony.
Right. And ignorance of the law is not a defense.
I understand
but,
that. Luckily for us. Thank you.
Further questions of Ms. Guy? Okay. Thank you very much, Kelly.
Thank you.
And now another Kelly Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. I just wanted to give you just a little bit of food for thought if you were ever going to work this bill and going, back to rewriting it. I certainly agree it's a difficult one to understand. We've been going through it and having a little trouble ourselves. A couple of instances that I would want you to be aware of that we think would cause problems if it just went through the way it is. There are some offenses in a commercial motor vehicle. Those are the big rigs, the buses, things like that, that under the federal regulations, which all states must abide by, or if they're out of compliance, then federal highway dollars at risk. And Oregon, along with all other states, has adopted the federal regs. Under some convictions in a commercial motor vehicle, it equals a lifetime suspension from having a commercial driver's license. Those are like DUI in a commercial motor vehicle, failure to perform duties of a driver involved in an accident in a commercial motor vehicle, manufacture distributing of drugs using a commercial motor vehicle. Those sorts of things would equal a lifetime suspension of the federal regulations. And we are concerned that if a conviction is set aside and it doesn't, and then we are supposed to undo the lifetime suspension and it doesn't meet the federal regulations of when that can be, that suspension could be lifted, if ever, that we somehow would be held out to be out of compliance. So we're a little concerned there. There are also some Oregon convictions, like Representative Prozanski was mentioning, and that is those involving a motor vehicle, murder, manslaughter, criminal negligent homicide, assault in a motor vehicle. Those sanctions after the person, if the person's incarcerated, and he's right, let's say they were in prison for 7 years, That's the court sentence. But then what you all have put on the books is that your driver's license is revoked from the time you get out of prison for another 8 years. And the reason you did that is because before, your revocation was happening while you were in prison, and you didn't even notice. I mean, obviously you're not trying to drive, you're in prison. So you wanted them to notice they had lost their driving privileges. And so if they, for example, like Representative Crumley, you're asking, if you're in prison for 7 years, your 10-year clock starts ticking the time you get sentenced, you get out, and then you've got 3 more years, you'd be under an 8-year revocation, but then 10 years would be up. So you'd be 3 years into your 8-year revocation, so 7 plus 3, 3 years into the 8-year revocation. You're supposed to be revoked for 5 more years, but if you get this conviction lifted, I think we'd have to lift the revocation. And so I just want you to know that there are some concerns out there, and that's all I really wanted to put on the record, Mr. Chair.
Okay, are there questions for Ms. Taylor? Hearing none.
Thank you
very much. It does seem to me that at some point, and we may want to add this to the list of possible interim discussions about a general review of that section of the statute. It is a complicated area, and I know there's a lot of issues surrounding it, and it seems like that might be the smarter approach than doing any kind of piecemeal work. Anybody else have any thoughts before I close the public hearing? Okay, public hearing on House Bill 2048 is closed. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2262. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 2262, which was pre-session filed at the request of the Governor's office, clarifies circumstances under which the Department of Transportation may immediately suspend the driving privileges of a person who causes or contributes to an accident that results in death. It's intended to clarify the procedures for such a suspension, places the burden of proof upon the Department of Transportation in establishing that the suspension is warranted, and it creates or it maintains the provisions regarding post-suspension review.
Thank you. And I will ask again Kelly Taylor from ODOT and Representative Bob Jensen, if you will both want to move to the witness table together. Is that okay with you, Representative Jensen? Representative Jensen, do you want to lead off on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the opportunity to be here to testify on 2262. This is a bill that originates, as many of our bills do, out of constituent issues. There was in 99, I believe, is that, yes, a violent sandstorm in eastern Oregon. Many of you may remember reading about it in the paper. There was something of a 45 car plus a pileup on I-84. In the process of that accident or accidents, there were fatalities involved. One of my constituents, and the person that precipitated my getting involved with this was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She left Stanfield to come to Pendleton and was in the middle of the accident. The constituent did nothing wrong other than leave Stanfield. She avoided, in fact, the accident entirely. She did what good drivers should do when they get into situations like that. She slowed down and, realizing the precarious position that she was in, took the ditch. And I guess did make one small mistake that cost the state probably a little money. She took out one of the little light reflectors on the way into the ditch, damaging her car and the little reflector as such. As a consequence, her car was nor was the constituent directly involved in the accident. Subsequently, however, DMV revoked her license along with all of the other licenses of people who were involved in that accident. She first checked out the idea of you know, legal advice, and was told by an attorney it would cost her $800, and that he wasn't sure whether that she would get her license back or not. The lady was a single mom, working in a job that required she have a car so she could commute to the job, and was at that point desperate. And she called our office, and we began a long and laborious process of trying to intervene to get her license renewed, or not renewed, but given back to her. Finally, after many telephone calls, the constituents' needs were met, but in an agreement with the department, I did not introduce legislation in the 01 session because the department assured me that they would be looking into this issue and they would take or try to take corrective action so that situations like this would not appear again in the future. I leave it to the committee's judgment as to whether or not they have accomplished this, and I must say that I am very thankful and very appreciative of the department for their follow-up on working with this. It certainly makes me feel good to know that when a problem is presented to them, they don't ignore it, you know, in such a way that would hopefully have allowed it to have gone away. So thank you very much. I'd answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Ms. Taylor, do you want to talk, and then we'll open it up for questions for both of you?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation. Representative Jensen has described how this bill came to be, and Mr. Joseph described what it's doing. It's changing the statute from saying we must suspend when these accidents happen, if someone causes or contributes to death of another person, and going from must suspend with the only discretion being whether or not it's an immediate suspension if we believe the person's a future endangerment, to saying it is discretionary on each case. Look at the case, read the documents, review the records, review the police reports, and then determine if suspension action is warranted. And if the person poses a future endangerment, we have the option of doing an immediate suspension. In either case, due process is maintained. I want to make sure everybody understands that. You'd still get a hearing even if we take an immediate suspension. And so we bring it to you. We also, in our review of it and working with the Assistant Attorney General's office and everything, we've also suggested that the terms injury and property damage be removed. Those are terms that have been very difficult through the years to try to define what level would equal suspension. And frankly, we don't get reports on injuries and necessarily property damage that would tell us what level it is anyway. So it narrows it to just death, and it makes it discretionary, which means we would not have the issue that happened with the I-84 sand storm. And so I'd ask the committee to support the bill.
Okay. Were there questions? Yes, Representative Sherlock.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kelly, I'm fine with this. You revisited about this, and I think it's appropriate to give the department discretion, because not all cases are the same, and I think it's worthwhile looking at them on an individual basis. But I do note that even under the current language, it requires not only that the driver has caused or contributed to an accident, but also that it be through incompetence, recklessness, criminal negligence, or unlawful operation. And so I'm assuming in that case that Representative Jensen, you were describing, somebody must have made a determination that there was either incompetence, recklessness, criminal negligence, or unlawful operation of a motor vehicle, and that certainly must have been subject to challenge before this suspension, or at least not maybe before, but as part and parcel with the suspension.
Mr. Chair and Representative Shetterly, you're correct. And what happened, I mean, that was an enormous accident with a lot of reports coming in, some of them piecemeal. And we were relying on information coming from the police officers at the scene. And it was very difficult to try to figure out who was the victim and who did something wrong. And so the reports were coming in with information, and we were acting upon them, and then got further information, which allowed us, like in Representative Jensen's constituent case, to remove the suspension. Okay.
Further, Representative McPherson, then Representative Ackerman.
Question for Ms. Taylor. If I'm reading the bill correctly, the existing language is bracketed at the top of page 5. The department immediately may suspend the driving privileges of any person, and so on. And I guess I'm having trouble seeing that as mandatory language that doesn't allow discretion. Could you explain, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative McPherson. This language has been on the books for a long time, and we've gone back and forth through the years. Let me draw your attention to the lines on page 4, lines 35 through 39. The way the statute just starts out, just saying, now this whole statute, by the way, is a suspension statute. So, causing or contributing to an accident resulting in death or injury to any other person, yada, 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 it goes all the way through. That is grounds for suspension. Then, little subsection A on top of page 5 kicks in. The department immediately may suspend. So what the Attorney General's office has advised us is the lines on 35 through 39 on page 4 are saying you will suspend in these cases. And on the top of page 5, your only discretion is whether to immediately suspend if the person's a future endangerment.
Okay.
It's written in a way that a lot of the other parts of the statutes are not. And so when Ledge Council drafted this bill, they tried to align it to make it similar to the others, which is putting right up front this is discretionary, and it's also discretionary to do an immediate suspension.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, Ms. Taylor. Assuming a manslaughter situation and that you invoke the provisions of this statute and immediately suspend a license, then the person is subsequently convicted of that crime, there would be another suspension. Do you intend this to be the only suspension applicable in that circumstance, or do you feel the department would have the authority to issue two suspensions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, in that situation, you're right. The manslaughter conviction may be somewhere down the road while the person's going through the court system. It is possible that we would, based on the accident report and the fatality report and everything, take action, be it immediate or not, I don't know. And if they were then convicted of manslaughter, these suspensions typically are a one-year suspension. That manslaughter conviction, after the person was released from incarceration, if they were not incarcerated, it would happen 8 years. A revocation would be 8 years from the date of conviction when we receive it. If they're incarcerated, that revocation would be 8 years from the date of the release from incarceration. And that's on the books separately. That's actually at the beginning of this section. So it is possible for those where they are convicted of a crime, like you're saying manslaughter with a motor vehicle, that they would have had two suspensions. That happens today under the DUI law. The court can order for DUI, and then the conviction comes in, and we have to suspend for DUI.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, thank you both. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2262. There was no one else signed up to testify. I guess I should ask that question. Was anyone else wanting to testify on 2262 before I close the public hearing? Okay, hearing none, we will open a work session on House Bill 2262.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Cromwell.
I'll move House Bill 2262 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves House Bill 2262 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yeah, we're in work session. Hearing none, Ann, call the roll.
Representative
Butler?
Aye.
Representative
Jensen? Aye.
Representative
Crummell? Aye.
Representative McGibson?
Aye.
Representative
Butler? Aye.
Representative Butler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. House Bill 2262 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Jensen, I assume you would like to carry your bill.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're very welcome. We are going to move the agenda to accommodate, and I apologize that it's taken us this long to get to this point, the Attorney General who is with us today. And this is opening a public hearing on House Bill 2340. And I am finding, as we speak, if I could have Mr. Myers come forward, Mr. Neely, the deputy director from DHS, welcome, Mr. Attorney General, and we're sorry we kept you waiting.
My time is your time, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Chair Williamson, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Hardy Myers, Attorney General, and I'm joined by Jim Neely of the Department of Human Services, and we appreciate the opportunity to open very briefly the committee's consideration of House Bill 2340. If this measure is approved by the legislature, it will complete a process of child support program consolidation that began in 1997 when the legislature voted to transfer from DHS to DOJ the so-called child support accounting unit. And that unit receives, records, and disperses the actual child support payments themselves, a flow of several hundred million dollars a biennium. Now, before that change, that function, as I said, was in the Department of Human Services. The Department of Justice and the district attorneys were responsible for getting these child support orders established, in some cases modified, and also for enforcing them. But that separation of those functions from the functions of receiving and paying out the child support payments themselves created a great deal of public confusion and frustration as to who exactly was responsible for problems when they arose in the receiving and dispersing process. And the proposal to shift that unit to the Department of Justice, approved, as I said, in 1997, was, as is the bill before you today, a joint proposal of the Department of Human Services and the Department of Justice. Now, that change left the Child Support Program Director's Office in the Department of Human Services. And this measure would transfer that office and functions, its functions to the Department of Justice, thereby, as I said earlier, completing the consolidation process, which began 5 years ago. I've distributed to you, Mr. Chair and members, a two-page document that recaps in some greater detail a number of the advantages that we think will be accomplished by consolidation, and I'm not going to go over all of those at this point. I would just quickly mention a couple or three. One, of course, consolidation clarifies and centralizes accountability for the program by marrying policy direction with the actual implementation of the program, and the Division of Child Support administers about 80% of all the child support cases in Oregon. You'll get that clarity and greater simplification, I think, of accountability to the legislature, to the wider public, particularly those Oregonians who are involved with the support program, accountability to the wider public generally. Consolidation will eliminate a lot of duplication of effort, and some of that is further detailed in the paper that I've had distributed to you. We think over time it will achieve some measure of program savings. At worst, it will be general fund neutral. The appropriation that is proposed in the governor's balanced budget, general fund appropriation, to be made to the Department of Justice if consolidation is approved, would be the same appropriation that would be recommended if Department of Human Services retained the director's office. And also, we think that given the very special working relationship between the Attorney General, Department of Justice, and the District Attorneys of Oregon, not only through the Child Support Program, but through the Criminal Justice Division, consolidation will give us a basis, I think, for an ever stronger relationship with our partners, the District Attorneys, in the program. So in sum, as I've described it before, including, I think, in my overview of the department to this committee a few weeks ago, this is really a truly a good government proposal. And I would just close by adding that it results, the proposal, the specific proposal before you, results from an immense amount of collaborative work this past biennium, involving DHS, DOJ, the district attorneys, and others. There was an oversight committee with about 8 or 9 subgroups working around different issues entailed in consolidation. And I genuinely think that the legislature can look with pride, actually, on that kind of collaborative work within government to try to develop and propose improvements in government, improvements in the delivery of service. So it's with that, Mr. Chairman, that I would close only by also saying that I very respectfully urge the committee to approve the measure that's been brought before you by the two departments.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. Mr. Neely, do you want to make some comments, and then we'll open it up to questions by the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Neely, Deputy Director of the Department of Human Services, and I'm here today to really echo the words of the Attorney General and to express the department's support for this transfer under House Bill 2340 and the amendments I believe you have before you. The child support program has always been a collaborative effort. I think this consolidation makes a lot of sense and by no means signals the end of that partnership between the Department of Human Services, the Department of Justice, and the district attorneys. Department of Human Services continues to have a huge stake in the child support program. We have a temporary assistance to needy families federal grant of $168 million a year that depends on a statewide approved child support program, and thousands, literally, of needy clients who also depend on the work of that program. I'm confident that the partnership remains intact. This is a good thing to do to consolidate this program, and again, we're very supportive of that.
Great. Are there questions for either the Attorney General or Mr. Neely? Representative Crummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, Mr. Myers. I thought you said that there would be some savings by moving the rest of the program, I guess, over to DOJ. Do you have an estimate of what those savings will be? And
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummel, I think that at least in the near term, they are relatively small. I believe one of my colleagues will probably be able to speak to a more exact number, but it's relatively, I think realistically, it's not large, at least initially. And I think that, quite candidly, I think probably the most realistic way to view this particular change, at least in the near term, that it is essentially general fund neutral, and that the benefits will emerge from other aspects to be realized from consolidation, some of which I was mentioning earlier. Now, what the prospect over time is of savings, I think probably will have to play out, but I think the committee can at least be absolutely confident that the transfer does not add to any general fund demand.
Okay. Follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Follow up.
In that respect, then, would the same people that are administering or assisting to administer or whatever they do on the DHS side then transfer over to DOJ, or would they be absorbed somewhere else in DHS? So when the transfer occurs, is it so? If I were a father paying child support, I guess what I'm asking is, I may call a different phone number, but am I going to basically talk to the same person and get the same type of help that I would get if it were remained on the DHS side?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummel, I believe the answer to that would be yes. Specifically, the transfer entails the shift of a certain number of authorized positions from DHS to DOJ, those positions being some of those that are presently forming part of the program director's office in DHS. And the two agencies have agreed, and the governor and DAS have signed off on how many positions that should be, which ones would come over. The child support program director's position itself, I think technically, is not being shifted because if consolidation occurs, the director would also be the head of the Division of Child Support within the Department of Justice. So those functions would merge. But there will be, I think it's five or... How many are coming over? Nine. I'm sorry. There are nine DHS positions related to the director's office that would transfer to DOJ.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Yes, Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick question. What will this have any adverse effect on local county or district attorney's office, any increased or decreased workload?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I believe the correct answer to that is no. The role, the functions of the authorities of the district attorneys within the total child support program are not affected by this proposal. They have been intimately involved in all of the interim work related to the development of the bill, and I believe that the committee will hear today that the District Attorneys Association is supporting the legislation.
Representative Anderson and then Representative Posansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I heard you say, Attorney General Myers, that approximately 80% of people would be moving, 20% would be staying. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no, what I said was that 80% of the active child support cases in Oregon right now, approximately 80% are administered by the Division of Child Support, 20% by the district attorneys.
But they'll all be consolidated through this?
No. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, no. The actual case responsibilities as between the Division of Child Support and the district attorneys are not affected as such by the consolidation. The position shift of nine positions from DHS to DOJ, coupled with the shift of the general fund appropriations and the authority to receive and spend the matching federal funds, those shift as well to DOJ. Those are the main, probably sort of organizational, budgetary ramifications of consolidation. But the respective work of the DAs compared with the Division of Child Support is not affected by this bill.
If I could perhaps instruct the committee, because this was a subject that we spent some time on during the interim, and it's been an issue that's percolated over the years. Essentially, what we're doing is we're taking the program management aspect from the Department of Human Services that had program administrative responsibility, and we're merging it with where most of the work on the actual casework was being done at Department of Justice, and we're moving that program management over to be with the people that are actually doing most of the work on the issue. So you've got the people down on the trenches and the people who are setting policy all sort of working in the same spot. I mean, that's essentially, is that a layman's approach, gentlemen, to sort of what's happening here?
Mr. Chair, absolutely accurate.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Any other questions for either of these gentlemen? Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from Cindy Chinook and Chinook. Sorry, Cindy. It just looked Chinook when I looked at it. Cindy Chinook and Ronell Schenkel. And those aren't easy names to say fast in the same breath.
Sure enough.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Cindy Chinook, the director of the Oregon Child Support Program, currently on leave of absence from Department of Justice during this interim year to help with the transition of the program, and I am a DHS employee today. I'm here just to provide a little more background and my personal commitment to you about what this consolidation means to the program. The mission of the Child Support Program is to help children receive financial support from both parents and to foster the strengthening of families by connecting them to community services. This consolidation will help us better meet our mission. And you heard from Attorney General Myers that the sort of neutral or cost neutral or maybe a small savings We are looking at projections of about $900,000 of a potential less cost for the program and the administration between the current and our fiscals for next biennium. Now, this is not necessarily a savings in that money is now available and free to use. It's really invested in other programs at this point, I believe, in DHS. But we will be going into a lot more detail with ways and means. Certainly, it is not additional cost, no new general fund for the program. The other thing, and you heard this from Jim Neely, is that we will, and I am personally committed to continuing the partnerships that we have developed to make this program a successful program and known nationally as a successful program. Those partnerships with the DHS programs is a primary. With the district attorneys is also the other primary partnership that we have. In addition, we have partnerships with the Oregon Youth Authority, with the Judicial Department, and with many other agencies with some of our enforcement programs. Finally, I just want to say that during this interim year, after we met with the Interim Judiciary Committee in March, we planned for and began a year of transition in July, where we have formed an interagency team of the administrative staff from DHS in the program and the DOJ administrative staff so that we could demonstrate the effectiveness of this consolidation in the interim year. I have also worked closely with the district attorneys, both those involved in the child support program and the elected DAs, to ensure that I understand whatever issues they might have and that we can work together as we set the direction for the program and we're moving the program forward. I am personally committed to continuing to lead the program toward our mission to the benefit of the families and especially the children in this state, and to collaborate with our partners and make sure that we're running a cost-effective program. In summary, I would just urge you to support this bill as we have worked together with all of the partners. We have demonstrated, I believe, the effectiveness of the consolidation, and the benefits to our customers will begin to be even more apparent as we go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Chenna.
For the record, Ronelle Schenkel with the Department of Justice. I am not going to walk you through the 49 pages and 71 sections of this bill. However, I am here to tell you that during the interim and as referenced in previous testimony, we have worked together throughout the program and with our partners. One of the committees that was working during the interim was a legislative consolidation committee, which I chaired. We basically took the draft that Interim Judiciary so kindly had drafted on this concept and have had it thoroughly reviewed by many players and attorneys, and hopefully have provided you with legislation that will take care of all the legal and procedural details necessary in a transfer such as this. You also have before you, I believe today, one page of -1 amendments, some final legal clarity and technical adjustments to language that are necessary in our opinion. I'll just point out for your reading pleasure later, basically sections 2 through 12 is the substantive language that sets up the directorship of the program in the Department of Justice. Section 60 then removes that language from the DHS authority. Section 20 is also noteworthy. In there is specific language about our commitment at the Department of Justice to an ongoing relationship with the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and specifically language about the DA liaison that works with our program and the role of the DAs, the ongoing role of the DAs in child support. Also noteworthy is Section 71. We are seeking an emergency effective date for this bill of July 1st. Much thinking went into that. It will take much work, but we are prepared to do so, and the logic is starting out the budget at the beginning of the biennium in the Department of Justice will save and be effective and efficient in government operations. So you've heard, and I will just reiterate, there is a fiscal impact statement. I believe this bill has a referral to Ways and Means. That is simply to transfer the budget authority and the staff referenced earlier, and I urge your support. I might also mention, Chair Williams, I on behalf of David Niebel, passed out along with my testimony, some written testimony that he has submitted. Legal Aid Services has been very involved in this issue throughout the years, and so that is their support of this bill.
Thank you. Are there questions for either Ms. Schenkel or Ms. Chinook? Okay. Thank you very much. Next, I'll ask Lane Barlow, Gary Dale, and Bob Whiteside if they could come up together. You want to start, Lane?
Thank you, Chair Williams. For the record, Lane Bartle from Oregon Men's Association. Don't think the Attorney General is going to like us a lot for this. We oppose the passage of House Bill 2340 in its entirety. We have some very good reasons for this, and we'd like to present those. On the first page of the testimony, the second paragraph, we've quoted Justice Edmonds of our Court of Appeals from the 1995 session. We actually came out of his courtroom or out of his chambers and entered into the record this little statement about House Bill 2695. There has been a trend to transfer control over the establishment of child support awards from trial courts to non-judges. I believe this trend disenfranchises voters who traditionally look to courts to establish child support awards. Those who set such policies in an agency context have no responsibility to the electorate at large, nor are they in contact with the individual needs of litigants. I can summarize our objections in a couple of statements. When you propose to take the entire child support program and place it under state prosecutors, you have a shift in policy, you have a shift in attitude with some of these other people who are consumers of this state's child support program, and Division of Child Support will testify too. There's a whole different attitude here, especially with House Bill 2111 and House Bills 2645 in their present forms. A child support caseworker, no matter how low they are, can literally has the same power of a judge. In House Bill 2645, which is on the agenda today, in page 1, lines, I think it's 13 and 14, it states that an administrative child support order is going to have all full force and effect and to be treated like and have the attributes of a circuit court judgment. I think it's Article 3 of our state constitution that promises us a separation of powers, gentlemen. You can't sit in one branch of the government, the executive branch is what's being proposed here, and perform the functions of the judicial branch. There's due process concerns and so forth. Another concern, very, very major concern, is that under the Department of Justice, which is under Mr. Myers and succeeding attorney generals, a caseworker will now be working under the direct authority of the prosecutors of this state. Therefore, any decision they have is going to be entitled to absolute immunity. They cannot be sued in court. Who are they accountable to? Translated, this means above the law. I'm going to introduce you to a case that's it's a good illustration of what's happened here. If you look to the next to the last page in our testimony, towards the bottom, you're going to see final. You can see final order. This is from an actual final order, which under current law and proposed law will have all full force and effect of a circuit court judgment. It says, no request for hearing having been received in the time allowed and no objection having been received in the time allowed, this order is entered as a final order. This was signed January 6, 2003 by Lynn Kay, the authorized representative of the state. She has full powers of a judge in this case. I call your attention to the last page. This is the copy of a letter faxed by
Mike, stand up.
Mike Spreen. Thank you. He faxed this to the Benton County Division of Child Support, and under the letterhead it says Department of Justice, last October, I think, is the 20th and the 21st, I believe. There are four labeled specific objections to the proposed order that he was served with, and the very last sentence says, I will look forward to your notice of the time and date of the hearing before the appropriate administrative tribunal. Now, go back to the final order. No requests for hearing having been received in the time allowed, and no objection having been received in the time allowed. This is a fraud. But the burden is now upon Mr. Spring to prove that's a fraud, and he's expected to hire an attorney to go into circuit court on this. Now, to the credit of the Division of Child Support, this has been called to the supervisor in the Benton County office. He did nothing. That was last October. Brought that to Ronell and Tammy's attention here earlier today, and actually we had a huddle, and there's a good chance that this may be resolved before Mr. Spreen has to have that actual court hearing. That's on March 17th. What we are showing you here is the actual operation of a case under the Division of Child Support under the Department of Justice. And what is being proposed here is that Ms. Kay is going to have absolute immunity for committing this fraud.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetterly.
Well, I don't want to get involved in litigating a case here, but if you look at the second sentence of this, Mr. Springs is, I decline to appear. I mean, a little bit. You can either appear and request a hearing. You can say, I'm not going to appear, and I don't recognize your authority to proceed. In which case, then, I guess you're going to have to choose. I wouldn't necessarily myself look at this as an appearance. I think it's just a matter of how it's presented. I wouldn't call this fraud, and I don't buy that. I think this raises some interesting issues as to what exactly the purpose and the effect of this notice is. I'm pleased the agency is willing to grant latitude here, and probably should, if indeed the purpose of this was to request a hearing. But I look at the intent of this as basically being a denial of the jurisdiction of the authority of the agency, and not so much any kind of a real response to the notice.
Representative Shetterly, of course, we're just brushing the tip of the iceberg in this case here. The state's notice of appeal was not to a hearing. It was to an appearance test that had no authority whatsoever except state of Oregon and a signature at the bottom. But there was no statutes, no rules. Nothing involved. And, of course, we're going to sort that out in court. Any of you wish to contact us later on, we'll be happy to put you in touch with Mr. Spreen and keep you in touch with this case. It's still a fraud because look at that final order. No objection having been received.
Mr. Barlow, I'm going to allow Representative Brzezinski to ask a question.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess two things regarding the alleged fraud from your perspective. That has not been adjudicated. I guess the court will adjudicate whether or not someone intentionally did that or didn't.
Yes.
We'll leave that to the court to decide. But isn't it true that under these type of orders, they are administrative orders that are appealable to the circuit court?
Yes, they are.
Thank you.
Lane, let me say that the challenge that I've got with the premise of your argument, which is that we don't want to shift the responsibility from DHS to the Department of Justice, ignores the DHS is already part of the executive branch. So your separation of powers issue, if you've got a problem with the administrative manner in which that we do this, much of which is mandated, frankly, by federal law, that's not going to matter whether it's at DHS, which is part of the executive branch, or whether it's over at the Attorney General's office. You may not like the way the Attorney General's office manages some of the case issues, but the separation of powers issue, it seems to me, just doesn't fly, given the fact that currently it's all in the hands of the executive branch of government. So I guess I'll just lay that on the table as sort of one of my problems with the approach that you're suggesting here. If you want to continue to talk to us, and I know you've got, I want to give the other two people a chance, and we've got other bills, and I want to hear from them, and we've still got a couple of other witnesses to testify on this bill who are also testifying in opposition. But I guess I'd like you, as opposed to just an all-out challenge to the way the office is currently handling all kinds of child support issues that you appear not to be happy with. If you could focus your comments to what is it about the transfer of just this small supervisory responsibility over to the Department of Justice that you're objecting to.
Thank you, Chair Williams. And I appreciate the challenges from both representatives here. At the end of last session, at the very last hearing before this committee, I testified that we were very satisfied with the current administrative and executive of the Division of Child Support and the direction it was going. At that time, child support program was actually presided over, directed by Kevin Aguirre, and there was a complete policy shift where all the GERS were treated as clients and listened to and cooperated with. You know, everything about DCS, of course, is not bad, and the child support program is not bad. We generally get cooperation, and they listen to us sometimes, and sometimes they don't. I'm going to end my testimony. We have written testimony here, which represents the feelings and the consensus of Oregon Men's Association. I would call your attention to the third page, which lists seven classes of amendments. What we're looking at, bottom line here, is accountability. Where's the accountability for the caseworkers who do the types of things that I brought up in Mr. Spring's case? And where's the gatekeepers? Where's the oversight? We're very willing to work with, and we have a history of working with Ms. Shankle and the other people that have a stake in this. And let's take this bill and make it better and address the concerns of the other people you're going to hear from. Thank you.
Thank you, Lane. Next, Mr. Dale.
I don't exactly know how to present this to make it fairly quick. I've been tied up in the support enforcement, and I've been divorced for 12 years. I've been tied up in support enforcement agency, not necessarily the support enforcement agency itself, the DA side. I've been very active and an activist in Central Oregon for many, many years. I've done surveys of over 3,000 people who have gone through this system, through the DA's office, moms, dads, uncles, aunts, on how they feel about this system. I can tell you that support enforcement over the years has done a lot of good. They are changing. The thing that concerns me is when, and this is no offense to anybody, is when you get attorneys involved. We've been very, very active in our judicial branch on getting mediators involved to eliminate a lot of the adversarial part of divorce. It's working very good. It's moving along very well in Oregon. It's cutting back cases is what I feel. My personal opinion is I don't think adding more attorneys to the situation is going to keep it from being adversarial. In my case, the law has never applied in my case. Never. I had a district attorney who indicted me on child support. Another district attorney took over for a day or two when I brought to their attention that the testimony before the grand jury was false. The district attorney who took over said, I think we have a real serious problem here. About a month later, this district attorney quit. It was handed back to the other district attorney. For a year and a half, I never received credit for any of my child support. And the false testimony was given to the judge for that year and a half. It was never corrected. I got so angry, I took the district attorney to court. I sued him. He never had to answer for his lies before the court, his lies before the grand jury. Because first words out of his mouth was, I claim absolute immunity because I'm an assistant DA. Granted, case dismissed. He walks away from the perjury. I'm still stuck with an indictment that was gotten falsely. I have found $7,500 in mistakes on my case. We brought it to the attention of Bob David. And I believe it was... Excuse me. 7,500. I lost my train of thought. Sorry. Support enforcement took my case over. I believe they did. My case is very complicated because it's been transferred back and forth. And that's one another thing that concerns me is you have a DA here, you have an attorney general here, and you have support enforcement. And when you start getting all these hands in the pot, do we really know what's going on with these cases? That can get very confusing. This 7,000... Why did I lose that? I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I am very sorry.
You know, I think we get a sense of your concern, Mr. Dale, and I guess I'd just suggest to you that in my view, and I know you may not agree with me, but in my view, actually the consolidation of this in one spot is actually going to help us manage this program in a more effective way. And I recognize that there's a lot of emotions surrounding many of these cases, and the individual facts of a particular case may be difficult to deal with, and I understand that. It isn't something that we're necessarily going to be able to address, obviously, here in this hearing today. But I think we understand the issues that you want to raise. I want to give Mr. Whiteside an opportunity to make his comments as well, but I'd like you to stay at the dais in case there are members that have particular questions for you. Are you all right with that?
Yeah, could I just add one thing really quick and turn it over to him? I guess the point I'm trying to get to is attorneys are prosecutors. They're not caseworkers. DHS or support enforcement has caseworkers. You can come to talk to caseworkers. How can the state expect us to come to a prosecutor and expect him to be a caseworker? That's not his job. I don't know if that's what's going to happen or not, but these are some of our concerns.
Yeah, and I understand. Let me explain that the current caseworkers right now that are doing the support enforcement work are currently employed by the Department of Justice. So it's going to be the same bodies doing that same work. It's only the program administration part that's moving over. So it's the people that you probably never had a lot of communication with at the top level that are shifting over. The day-to-day people working on those cases aren't lawyers, but they are employees of the Department of Justice, and it's been that way for quite some time. Mr. Whiteside, do you want to make a few comments to us?
Yes, my name is Bob Whiteside. I'm a resident of Beaverton, Oregon, and I reside in your district, Representative Barker. I'm here as a concerned citizen. I'm not affiliated with any group. I have experience dealing with the Oregon Child Support Program for 16 years, spanning from 1986 to 2002, and I'm opposed to the change. And I'd like to relate some of my personal experiences and then compare and contrast how I see the differences between the old system and the new system and what its impact is on the parents and the people who are the constituents of the system. And in the four areas I'd like to cover are communication style differences, program creep and what it means, constituent outreach and the need for that, and how the different and varying interpretations of legislative intent are interpreted between the two groups. And I would hope that as a result of my testimony that the committee would think about the impact on individual parents and what that means to the citizens who are impacted by all of these changes. There's thousands of us that would be impacted by the change. And just examine in your process whether you believe this change is politically motivated or whether you believe it is really intended to make the child support program work better for the people who are within the system. In the first area of communication styles, there's a significant difference between the way Department of Human Services and Department of Justice communicate with the constituents of their program. The people within the Department of Human Services, sometimes it's difficult to get to respond to you, and you have to be very persistent in your follow-up, and you have to file grievances occasionally, but eventually they open up the lines of communication with you. My experience with the Department of Justice personnel is that they're prosecutors. They go by the book. They refuse to communicate, and most of the time the only way they'll talk to you is through some kind of a legal proceeding that they've initiated. And also my experience with Department of Justice personnel is that they stonewall you when you try to communicate with them, and they obfuscate the issues and come up with unrelated things involved with the case. So my conclusion is that a change like this isn't going to change the Department of Justice's attitude, which is pay up or else, and we're always right, and that's just the way we do it.
So there are some underlying issues with the way the different groups treat the constituent parents. In the area of program creep, my concern is that the dirty secret behind child support is it isn't about children at all. It's about how adults gain power. And the judges and the attorney generals and the district attorneys and the lawyers and the bureaucratic police and all the people that benefit from this system are out to advance their own personal agendas. And the children are lost in the process. What's been created here is a perpetual motion revenue generating machine for the state that destroys families and separates fathers from their children. And the more fathers they can separate from the children, the more growth they can establish within the system to keep it going. So my conclusion is that we're going in the wrong direction, that by consolidating all the child support functions into one group is like creating an unchecked monopoly where they will be controlling every aspect of the system, from creating orders and establishing paternity, establishing what the child support guidelines are, collecting the orders, performing all the accounting functions, reviewing orders, modifying them, enforcing the orders, managing the official records on every case, and writing administrative rules. So they have total control of the entire process. And there's no place to go except to one individual group. The third area I wanted to talk about is constituent disregard. And I agree with the testimony from Attorney General Hardy Myers in that there is confusion in the program. But the problem is that there's no outreach from the program to the people who are impacted by the various changes to explain to them who does what in the system and where to go if you need help. And so I cannot agree with the fact that this could be possibly a revenue-neutral change. Because if the people who are impacted by the system aren't notified of what all the changes are, then there's tremendous expense related to that, because there's 54 sections of the Oregon State statutes that are being amended by this bill, you know, it's a waste of time. And the communication is so significant that it can't be ignored. And then finally, in the area of legislative intent, it's the most troubling area that I wanted to talk about today. All of the state agencies have staffs that provide their interpretation of what legislative intent is behind the creation. And I want to use the Child Attending School Statute, ORS 107.108, as an example of how that works. The legislature created a statute to provide for continuing child support for a child attending school between the ages of 18 and 21, as long as that child meets specific criteria for continuing that support to be paid directly to them. And that seems pretty clear and direct in the way that it's written. However, the executive branch interprets that as meaning that the child only gets current support and arrearages go to the judgment creditor, and that a failure to comply will cease the accruals of child support. Yet the judicial branch interprets that differently, as a different legislative intent, stating that child attending school is an automatic extension of child support, and should the child fail to qualify for the ongoing child support, the money then goes back to the judgment creditor until a court acts. So you have one law, one way written by the legislature, a different legislative intent interpreted by the Department of Justice, and a third legislative intent interpreted by the Department of Human Services in the way they administrate the cases. So my point is that with all the alternative interpretations, passage of this bill will create new administrative rules being written to reflect the Department of Justice's position on some of these issues. And if this the child attending school statute is representative of the other statutes that are being amended by this House bill, then there's the potential cost of writing and recasting 54 different administrative rules related to how the statute's interpreted and implemented. That's all I had to say. If you have any questions, I'd like to answer
them.
Okay,
thank you very much, Mr. Whiteside. Are there any questions for either Mr. Dale or Mr. Whiteside?
I just have one question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Cromwell.
And please don't take this way it may sound, and I certainly don't mean to be inflammatory. But in your testimony, it almost sounded like you were sort of interchangeably utilizing the terms Department of Justice and Judicial Branch. And I just want to make sure that, because I think it can be very confusing, and it goes back to the days of statehood, but the Department of Justice is not the judicial branch of government. And I just want to make sure that you understand that.
Chairman Williams and Representative Krummel, I do understand that. However, in the trenches where this stuff gets done, there's a close symbiotic relationship between the local DAs that are contracted and the judicial branch. And believe me, I've been in courtrooms and watched them call each other by their first names. They all know who each other are. They work together on a day-to-day basis. And so although I understand the legal distinctions between the two, when it comes down to the practical aspect of how they work together hand in hand, day in, day out.
Well, the DAs are part of, the judicial branch of government. But the Department of Justice, and Representative Pozanski will correct me if I'm wrong, but the Department of Justice is the executive equivalent. The Attorney General's office runs the Department of Justice, and the DOJ is part of the executive branch of government. And that's where I'm making the distinction. Now, correct me, please.
Representative Pozanski.
The district attorney is actually a state executive officer, and it is the executive branch. It works within the judicial branch in the sense of it presents the case for the state, but they are part of the executive branch.
I stand corrected. Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you. I'm going to ask the last two witnesses on this bill, John Baker and Debbie. Is it Ferry? If you want to come up, if you would, please, both at the same time. And to the extent you can not repeat issues that have already been raised, the committee would appreciate it based on the need that we have to economize our time.
Ladies first.
Oh, okay. I'll wait until he gets that handed out. My name is Debbie Ferry. I am a citizen of Marion County. I currently have an active support order. I am obviously female. I'm a non-custodial parent, and I pay $1,129.50 a month for three children. And I am here today to oppose the transition of the child support program from Department of Human Services to Department of Justice. I'm also here today to talk about a program that doesn't work. And I'm here today to advocate for a balanced child support program. I represent parents who've been denied time with their children by the other parent based on child support issues, such as, you can see the kids when you send me the check. I represent parents who have ever paid child support in the past, present, and future, who will and see and do their child support dollars not spent on their children, and who have, do, and will suffer, both parents and children, because of the fear of trying to change things and seeing their children not taken care of. I represent parents who are imprisoned financially by the child support guidelines as written today and proposed, imprisoned by the double whammy, the double support burden of parenting time costs, and in the exercise of pursuing one's potential and having to turn over that potential and the proceeds to the other parent in child support. I represent parents who are fearful to stand up and say, this is not right. It is not just, and it is hurting me and my children. I represent accountability, responsibility, and enforcement of child support for those who pay it, those who receive it, and those who spend it. And there is a lot of room in this state to work on a child support program that supports both payers and receivers. I have been working with Cindy Chinook, Rennell, several of the people behind me for the last year in the advocacy meetings that have been held in Wilsonville. I would like to say they're greatly attended. They're not. In fact, the last one, I was the only one there sitting around the table with four Department of Justice child support people.
Now, that's service.
That's service. That's, yeah. I had their attention. And some of the interesting things that I learned is that Department of Justice approximately has 247 cases. 50% of those are managed by counties. I'm one of those people. Okay, I receive no public assistance. None of my children are in the wards of the state or anything, or OYA. So I represent, yeah.
Debbie, we've got your stuff, and I'm looking at it, and there's a lot of information here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to ask you, because of our time constraint today and the issue that is the bill in front of us, which is the transfer of the responsibility from DHS to DOJ, to limit your discussion to your objections to that issue.
Okay.
This isn't a full vetting today of everybody's concerns about the way the child support program works in Oregon. We can do that another time, maybe, but we're not going to do it today on this bill.
Okay, then let me hit the high points. Page 3. The mentality of pay up or else is the tone, action, and behavior of DOJ, Department of Child Support. That's what it communicates. What is important to DOJ is money, the collection of it, and the unaccountable justice of its redistribution. Performance measures is outlined in their annual report. DOJ considers themselves successful because of the number of men found who father children and who have the financial obligation who now the DOJ can go after. But nobody ever asked, of those paternities established, how many of those fathers are allowed to participate in the lives of their children. On page 16, DOJ considers more money they collect, the more successful they are. And here are some other performance measures that are uncollected and undocumented. Of the dollars collected, how much was actually spent on the children receiving those dollars or the other parent? Of the dollars collected, how much was from the paying parent who had to work more than one job? How many times did a parent get denied a minute of parenting time because the other parent was not paid in full?
Okay, let me ask you a question, Debbie. Did DHS do those measures? I mean, again, we're focusing on the transfer of the program from DHS to DOJ management. This isn't, again, about the way DOJ does its business, unless you can relate it back to some difference in how it was being managed at DHS. That's the issue in front of the committee.
The issue that I would like to address is I would like to feel, as a paying parent, that I have a place to go when I have a problem. And I can already tell you that when I go up to the window on the third floor of Courthouse Square and say, I just got laid off, how do I stop my child support payment? They look at me and say, submit a modification C in 6 months. That does me no good when my arrears is going to be $7,500 in 6 months. I need a place to go where I can get help. And it's not Department of Justice, because their job is to collect money. They're rewarded for it. They get bonuses from the federal government for it. And that is not acceptable for me as a paying parent. I need a place to go that I don't need to hire an attorney. I don't have to submit the paperwork myself, that can look at my case and go, you're right, Debbie, you're paying way too much money in child support, your kids aren't getting it, and the whole system needs to be reworked to be balanced. I want someone to ensure that the money that I pay my ex-spouse to take care of my three children actually goes to them. And nobody behind me is making that happen without me hiring an attorney and then forcing discovery on my ex-spouse. That is accountability. That's a balanced program, and I'm dying to see it, just like a bunch of other parents in this state.
Okay, thank you. John.
Yes. My name is John Baker. I'm here just as a father. I was a non-custodial parent of my son for 3 years. Last fall, I gained full custody of my son, and he's now living with me. I oppose this bill. Mainly, my opinion is that the Department of Human Services is a more service-oriented, person-centered organization, where they're there to support the safety net for people, to, if something needs to be adjusted, they can adjust it rather than going through a court proceeding. The Department of Justice is basically a law enforcement agency. Their job is to prosecute, incarcerate, and punish criminals. Both agencies perform their functions extremely well. The problems come when they try to perform the opposite function. By transferring child support enforcement to the Department of Justice, you are in effect criminalizing non-custodial parents. Now, I'm arguing a point opposed to where I am as a custodial parent. But if the Department of Justice deals with criminals daily, it should be no surprise
that they will tend to look at the persons they deal with as possible, if not probable, criminals. This is unfair to thousands of non-custodial parents. Men have a hard enough time adjusting to the fact that due to divorce, they are no longer full-time parents, but rather a visitor to their children. Let's not treat them as criminals also. I urge you to please block this bill from being enacted. One of the statements that was made earlier, I forget who it was from, stated that the caseworkers are going to basically be the same caseworkers. There'll just be a different management in charge of them. Caseworkers will tend to reflect the overall attitude of their supervisors. Therefore, if the supervisors are in the Department of Justice, the attitude of the caseworkers will tend to lean towards a prosecutorial bent.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Are there questions for either witness? Okay, thank you. I do want to say, and I think people have a misunderstanding about what this bill is actually doing. The caseworker operation for the collection of child support has been for some number of years housed at the Department of Justice, so there isn't any change in that aspect of what this transfer is going to do. I want to make sure people understand that and recognize that point. We're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2304, although I am tempted, and I guess I want to give, there were a lot of statements made. I don't want to do a tit-for-tat response, but I do want to give the Attorney General, who has stayed through the hearing, an opportunity if you want to make any other statement on the record in response to the comments you've heard today. You're not obligated to, Mr. Attorney General, but I don't want to deny you that opportunity if you feel the need.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I know you wish to conclude the hearing. I would just say, perhaps by way of underscoring what you were just commenting on a moment ago, that that what's involved in this transfer is the issue of the overall policy direction that's now exercised, and certain other functions, now exercised within the Director's Office at DHS. The on-the-ground administration of the actual cases themselves, the manner in which support is established and entered, is enforced, is accounted for, all of that has been under the Department of Justice for many years and is completely unaffected by this proposed change. And I think that's the most important thing to have clear in everyone's mind, that issues around the, as I say, on-the-ground administration of the thousands of cases within the system, that day-to-day work is not implicated by this structural proposal.
Okay. Thank you, Attorney General Myers. Okay, we are closing the public hearing now on House Bill 2340. We're going to circle back, colleagues, because you should have in your possession an amendment to the bill that we addressed, House Bill 2270, a -3 amendment. Does everybody have that in front of them? So I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2270.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrilly.
I think the first motion would be to rescind from the -1 amendments that we moved into the bill because they appear to be subsumed in the -3. So I would make that motion.
Representative Sherrilly moves that we rescind the adoption of the -1 amendments to House Bill 2270 from the prior work session. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? Hearing none, the -1 amendments have been rescinded. Representative Sherrilly.
Mr. Chair.
Representative.
I think we actually did the -2s.
Oh, was it the -2s? I'm sorry. Then if you'll just amend my motion. Amend my motion to the -2s.
All right. The motion has been amended to rescind the -1 amendments.
No, the -2s.
For the -2s. Yeah. Okay. All right. We'll get this right.
Mr. Chair.
Two amendments. Representative McPherson.
This is probably falls in the category of knowing too much about the subject matter, but
you've still got a problem with line 4.
I do, and it's a very technical point, but the fact is that any profit-sharing plan that defers compensation until the end of employment, which in my experience are those which have a beneficiary designation associated with them, would be included within the reference to ERISA Title I pension plans. Any plan that does not defer it to the end of employment would, like any other bonus arrangement, generally would not. And I think it's it's not an important issue, but it would be slightly confusing to at least those of us who practice in the field to add profit sharing to the plan. So I would favor deletion of the line four, which I think could be accomplished without holding up our action on the amendment.
Okay. He's referencing the dash three amendments. Representative Shirley, any thoughts on that?
No, other than that we're still under the motion to rescind, I think. But
We are. So we'll get there. We need to fix the rescind motion, and it was the dash two amendments. Which are going to be rescinded. Any objection? So rescinded. Now, we've got the dash threes in front of us.
I'll move the dash threes to House Bill 2270. Do you want to get into conceptual amendments?
I think I do actually. To the extent that, Representative McPherson is our resident benefits lawyer on the committee.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Sherrill.
I think the first then would be to make a conceptual amendment to the dash three amendments to delete.
Line four.
Do we need to retain the or? Page one, line 23. Mr. Chair, it would be to conceptually amend the dash threes by deleting on line four the parentheses and the small g, and then the words "a profit sharing plan," and the semicolon, since that's inserted in line two, and then on line five to conceptually amend the dash threes to change the small g to a small, small h to a small g.
Okay. That is the motion to conceptually amend the dash three amendments as Representative Shetterly outlined. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, question.
Representative Krummel.
So I just want to make sure that I'm going to be reading this correctly. An employee annuity including starting on line 24 of the bill. An employee F applying an employee annuity including custodial accounts treated as annuities under section 403A or B of the Internal Revenue Code, or a stock certificate or a mutual fund account. Am I reading that correctly then?
I believe so.
Mr. Chair, with just the notation, there would be a semicolon on line 25 after code, and then or. That
That's it.
That's okay. Right. And that's right. And then the a stock certificate, that would be that would become subparagraph G.
All right, that's the motion. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? The amendments have been conceptually amended.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Shetland.
I move the dash three amendment as conceptually amended to House Bill 2270.
Representative Shetterly moves the dash three amendments as conceptually amended to House Bill 2270. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The amendments have been adopted.
Other than Dave Hendricks' downstairs one.
Yeah, right. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill 2270 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2270 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative Barker.
Just briefly, I still have the same objection I had before. I think somebody could leave life insurance, somebody who's divorced that gets along with their former spouse might still want to leave life insurance in their name, and I think this would preempt or keep them from doing that unless they went out of their way to make additional corrections. I think the beneficiary and life insurance policy should stand, and I'm not going to support the bill based on that.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
Well, I can just respond to that. I mean, that's a legitimate concern. I guess what we're doing is we're making a policy choice that, absent some affirmative action, more people would likely choose A or B. And I think, just as we do in the laws of intestate succession, I think it's a fair assumption that more people probably would not continue a designation of the former spouse. And so we're putting the onus on that smaller group of people to re-up, to renew that beneficiary designation after the divorce, rather than the onus on the larger group of people who I think just because they're the ones who more likely would do what we are creating as the default mechanism in this bill.
That's fine, Representative Barker. Representative Shetterly, any other comments on the bill?
Well, I might just amplify on what Representative Shetterly said, if I could, Mr. Chair, which is that of the various kind of theoretical problems that have come up in my law practice, this is one that is not so theoretical. It is one that actually has happened on a number of occasions where language in a plan document that has the effect of what this amendment, this bill would do, has saved the day in terms of accomplishing what appeared the decedent had wanted to have happen, rather than have created an unintended consequence. And so I think this is a good statement of policy.
Okay. Anybody else? All right. The motion is to move the bill as amended with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Ann, would you call the roll?
Representative Barker?
No.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Plummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Buzowski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. And House Bill 2270 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We won't ask Representative Barker to carry the bill.
My Republican colleagues keep talking about individual responsibility and things. I just said.
All right. Nice shot.
How partisan.
Nice. Yeah. And for that reason, I'm assigning the bill to Representative McPherson.
That's right.
Fair enough. Colleagues, we have some other bills on the agenda. I know we're pushing the time. We have some witnesses who have traveled some distance to testify. To the extent that I could keep a quorum for a few more minutes to get as far down the agenda as we can, I'd appreciate it. I know some of you may have to leave for other commitments. I am interested in opening a work session on House Bill, or excuse me, a public hearing on House Bill 2263. And I'm going to ask Kelly Taylor and Carl Meyer to come forward together. And then when they're done testifying, I'm going to ask Lane Barlow and John Baker to come forward together. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. We asked this bill to be introduced in order to try to strengthen the process that's been in place to hold drivers accountable for their driving behavior. Basically, what happens in this bill is that it would say that if you are suspended for failure to appear at a court hearing on a traffic citation, you would not be eligible for a hardship permit. Let me explain. Under Oregon law, when I get a traffic ticket, and a cop gives me a ticket, and I'm supposed to go to court on a certain date, if I don't show up on that date, if I just plain don't show up, the court can order my driving privileges to be suspended. The court will send the person notice, and it will tell us to suspend the person. We will send the person a 60-day notice saying, if you don't go to the court and clear this matter up, before a certain date, you will be suspended. Now, by clearing the matter up, it doesn't mean you have to pay the ticket in full. It simply means you need to go appear at the court and start making arrangements, payment arrangements with that court on that ticket, if you're found guilty. You may be found innocent, but in any case, you need to go show up. What is happening is the court is suspending for fail to appear. That is their stick in the law to try to give the person incentive to go to court. The person's not showing up, and they're using the hardship permit, that's a restricted license, as sort of a loophole to continue to drive legally, ignoring the court, ignoring the ticket, never being found innocent or guilty, never paying a fine if guilty, and never having the ticket going on the record. Now, a hardship permit does not come easily. A hardship permit, you have to pay $125 to DMV to get it. You have to pay for insurance, higher risk insurance, and SR-22. So, in theory, you could be going to the court and making payments and having a full license back and not having to have a restricted license. This is simply saying, hold folks accountable, have them go to court, and not drive around on a hardship permit instead. And that would ask the committee to support the bill.
Maybe not this one. Okay, Mr. Myers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, for your record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Justices, the Peace Association, the Oregon Municipal Judges Association. We support the bill as an additional tool for the courts to enforce their judgments, to get people to come in front of them in the first place, which is a significant problem for local courts. A lot of people fail to appear when they get the ticket and actually never come back in front of us, but for, in some cases, they want their license for one reason or other, and they'll come in a considerable time down the line to try to make amends. This will, those that are eligible for a hardship permit may never have to come in and even discuss the case with us or allow anything other than a default judgment to be entered. We in the local courts particularly have little clout in enforcing people to appear in front of us. We can order a warrant for their arrest, but a lot of there aren't jail facilities, and a lot of courts don't do that because they don't have court-appointed counsel that would be required if we were going to threaten somebody with jail. So eliminating the ability to get a hardship permit would be beneficial on those few cases where it's a blatant disregard for their responsibilities to the court. With that, I'll be happy to respond to questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? The Dash 1 amendment?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I forgot to mention that. The Dash 1 amendments would also add suspension for failed to comply. That is, someone who has now appeared, made arrangements for payments, and has defaulted on those. The court would suspend on those. This would also, under the Dash 1, say no hardship permit to that issue either. Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Okay. Ms. Barlow, Mr. Baker.
Chairman Williams, members of the committee, I may well have looked at this with a little bit of blinders on in my regards to what the failure to appear for what, I guess. I'm sorry, my name is John Baker. I'm from Gresham, Oregon. I've just come down on my own today. I was looking at this more in a child support custody issue and looking at a failure to appear to a court request to be in court for that, and then the possibility from there.
Excuse me, I do have testimony also. Thank you.
The possibility of losing one's license for failing to go to a custodial evaluation, to go to a court hearing, to go to something along those lines,
right.
And looking at this in those directions.
And because of our time, Mr. Baker, I'm going to try to narrow your testimony. You've heard the testimony from the Department of Transportation that it's specifically to people who are failing to appear for traffic infractions that they've been cited for under ORS 809-280 sub 5 or 809-290 sub 1 or based on the amendment sub 2 of 809.290. So it's very limited to that area. It's not a failure to appear for a support hearing or anything like that that's being used in this issue. So if that's not being implicated in any way by this bill, do you have anything to say in opposition to it? We're talking about people
Good.
Thank you very much. Mr. Barlow?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Lane Barlow, Oregon Men's Association. You have a copy of our testimony and proposed amendments. I'm going to make this real short and sweet. One of those people that drove over 100 miles to get down here, and I want to be able to enter testimony in two more bills. What I want to call your attention to is lines 23 and 24 of the bill. We want to change that. Currently, under current law, there are only three classes of drivers absolutely prohibited from even applying for a child or for, sorry, I'm on child support mode here, for a hardship permit after the driver's license has been suspended. One of them is, one class is those whose license has been suspended or revoked by a court of law. Second is those that have been convicted of driving while under the influence of inhalants and controlled substances. And third is convicted of basically driving as a deadbeat dad, I guess you'd say. This is how ridiculous this law is. Drunk drivers and those convicted of reckless driving are able to get hardship permits. There should be able to, people who have license suspended for child support should be able to get hardship permits also. State opened the door on this. We're going to take advantage of it.
Okay, so you'd like an amendment to take the deadbeat dad part out, but you don't have any objection to the Department of Transportation's...
Absolutely not. We can just take line 23, the department may issue a hardship permit to a person, blah, blah, blah. We'll be real happy with that.
Yeah, well, I bet you would.
That's the end.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Is there questions for Mr. Barlow? Okay, thank you. Thank you, Lane. Going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2263. We're going to open a work session on House Bill 2263.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Przanski.
I move the dash ones into 2263.
Representative Przanski moves the dash ones into House Bill 2263. Is there any discussion on the dash ones? Any objection? The bill is amended. Okay.
I'm all right with the dash ones.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 2263 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2263 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some reservations about this bill. I have reservations about the limiting of a hardship permit, especially true in my part of the state where jobs are sometimes a long ways away from where one resides, and the possibility of preventing a person from continuation of those jobs presents me a real problem. Any further obstacles imposed by statute that would do that presents for me a problem.
And I understand your concern, Representative Jensen. It's a similar concern I had when I first looked at the bill until I understood a little bit more about how you get a hardship permit. And the challenge you've got is you've got people who have been cited for infraction or violation. They haven't paid it for whatever reason, and yet they go in and they spend $150 to get the hardship permit, when if they would simply have gotten their infraction or violation or cumulative perhaps violations resolved, they wouldn't need to get the hardship permit. But they've gotten a suspension based on their failure to appear, and at some point you've got to give the court sufficient authority that people who get cited into court on these issues actually come in and get the thing taken care of. And if they can come up with $150, and they don't require a payment, Representative Jensen, all at one time. They work out payment plans for people, and if they can afford the $150 to get the hardship permit, I was convinced in my conversations with the Department of Transportation in the court on this issue that they can afford to sit down and come in and work out a payment plan and start making payments on the thing, which will then allow them to go forward and get a hardship permit if they got the thing resolved. That's how I reconcile my concerns that I had, which were very similar to yours. You may not be as reconcilable on that point as I am, but I wanted to let you know that I had shared those same concerns and had gotten comfortable with them based on my conversations.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Is there any further discussion on Representative Przanski's motion to move 2263 to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Question.
Yes, Representative Ann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I understand then that if the person who's cited and neglects to go into court and get the suspension later realizes that he's got a problem and that he can go back to the court and have that clarified and
Ms. Taylor, do you want to explain the process a little bit for us?
Again, Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson and Representative Jensen. If the person, when they get notified that they would be suspended, which is a 60-day notice ahead of time, okay, we give them 60-day notice, when they go back into court, there will be no suspension. They will not need a hardship. They'll have their full license back. So they can go back to court, simply appear, and start making arrangements for payments, even small payments. I've heard courts taking $5 a month on some payments. So they won't need a hardship at all. They'll get their full license back and be able to drive to and from work.
Any further discussion? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As long as Ms. Taylor is there at the table, would she be willing to respond to the issue on line 24 with regards to ORS 25-250, excuse me, and the issue that's been raised by the...
I'm not sure. I mean, you can certainly ask her, Representative Crummell. I'm not sure that because the Department of Transportation primarily simply administers the license revocation process, the policy issue of our decision to suspend and not give hardship permits to fathers who fail to pay child support isn't an issue that Ms. Taylor and her department got to weigh in on. That's a question probably better put to the folks from the Child Support Division that are sitting in the front row who didn't sign up to testify on this bill.
I'm just wondering from a standpoint of revocation of a license or suspension of a license, how does a DMV administer that? I mean, very quickly, how do they administer that? Is that something that, I mean, you just get a notice from Child Support, for example, and then you issue a notice of suspension?
Mr. Chair and Representative Crummell, the chair is right. All the due process and everything is handled through the department that's issuing the suspension for child support. We simply are the recording agency at that time. You've already been told you were going to be suspended. We will go ahead and send another notice out, but your due process and everything is handled through the child support agency. And it's sort of the same theory that this bill is that you won't be suspended if you go make arrangements to take care of the problem in the first place. So you won't, you know, so it's, again, it's the incentive for you to go show up and take care of your obligation, and then you won't have a suspension at all.
Thank you. That's the thing.
Does that answer your question?
That does.
Great. Okay, the motion pending is to move House Bill as 2263 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Hearing
yes,
done.
Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Just for the record on this, I will vote in support of this, but I maintain my position and concern about the issue of hardship, denial of hardship permit for those people who driving to and from work is a necessity. And I certainly would have exception or take exception with the hardship permits, that the line 24 that Representative Carmel was referring to.
Okay, thank you. Noted for the record, and I'd encourage the department to talk to you further to address your concerns. With that, ma'am, go ahead and call the roll.
Representative Barber?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pozanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2263 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'll carry it.
You want to carry it?
Yeah.
Okay, Representative Pozanski. Well, I've still got a quorum, colleagues. We're going to do quickly the measure introduction today. There are, I think, in front of you, I'd like to say there are three, but I'm afraid you may only have two.
I have three in front of me.
Do you have three in front of you? Three LCs?
Take the other one out.
2762, 2483, and 3177?
Right. That's right. So you have LC 2483. It's a bill involving bingo game conducted by charitable, fraternal, or religious organization. Authorizes the department to license gaming equipment manufacturers and escrow agents holding prize money. Allows licensed gaming equipment manufacturers and suppliers to rent or lease equipment to organization. The second one you have, LC 3177. I am trying to find here. This one has a very long summary, but it deals with the Department of Transportation and disclosing Social Security numbers. And I'm looking for the submitter on this one, and I can't tell you who it is right now. And then the third one, LC 2762. requires local government to refund or reimburse appeal fee and transient costs incurred by persons who successfully appeal local land use decision. So all three of those bills are being presented for introduction as committee bills, as is always the case. Your support of the vote to introduce them as committee bills in no way indicates your support of the bill or your opposition to the bill at any future time in the process. So the chair would move introduction of LC 2483, 3177, and 2762 as committee bills. Is there any discussion, any objection? The bills will be introduced as committee bills. We are at almost 3:30, and I apologize to those who have traveled, but given the length of our hearing today, we've gone over and we still have not reached discussions on House Bill 2277 and 2645. Those bills will be carried over to a later date. To the extent that you have traveled some distance and you want to submit your written testimony now, you can do that to the committee council. That will be distributed at the time the bills are reposted and at the next hearing process. And again, we apologize for any inconvenience caused by that delay. With that, colleagues, I appreciate you sticking it out with us till 3:30 today, and the committee is adjourned.